Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
New Books in Southeast Asian Studies is sponsored by the ANU Southeast Asia Institute, the Griffith Asia Institute, the New York Southeast Asia Network, the Nordic Institute of Asian Studies, and the Sydney Southeast Asia Centre.
Welcome to New Books Network in Southeast Asian Studies, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm Nicole Corato, Professor of Political Sociology at the Centre for Deliberative Democracy and Global Governance at the University of Canberra, Australia, and co-host of the channel. Today, I'm talking to Professor Lynette J. Chua, Professor of Law from the National University of Singapore. Professor Chua is the author of Politics of Rights in Southeast Asia, published by Cambridge University Press in 2022. Her book examines the structural conditions that influence the emergence of rights mobilization in the region, the various ways in which people mobilize these rights, and the consequences of these mobilizations. Professor Chua, welcome to New Books Network in Southeast Asian Studies.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for inviting me to the show.
All right. So let's start with a puzzle you set out in the introduction. Southeast Asia is a diverse region. There are various normative orders and meanings associated to rights, various genealogies, etc. And so the book proposed a socio-legal approach of politics of rights as the analytical starting point. So first, give us a sense of what a socio-legal approach entails. And second, why do you think this was a good starting point for such a complex topic?
What I mean by socio-legal approach is actually linked to the field in which I specialize, which is law and society, sometimes referred to also as socio-legal studies. The socio-legal approach to the study of law regards law as a social phenomenon or a social fact that we as scholars set out to investigate, and we are interested in the ways in which law is embedded in society, in other normative orders such as gender, class, and other social structures. And we're interested in how law and these other social structures and relations shape one another. What is the impact of the use of law on people's identities, on the social relations, and so on and so forth. In other words, unlike, let's say, and this perhaps goes into a little bit of caricature, but I think it's helpful to explain what I mean by a socio-legal approach. Unlike conventional legal scholars who might study cases or court opinions and statutes, trying to interpret what the legislature of a particular government intended the law to be, socio-legal scholars or law and society scholars are interested in these, in how law actually plays out in action on the ground. And so therefore, we do not take the statute provisions or court opinion as a given, but rather we investigate how they actually play out on the ground. And to do that, we often, or we usually employ methods that are very common in the social sciences, such as participant observation, interviews, ethnography, historical or archival work, discourse analysis, and so on and so forth. And from there, we try to understand the meanings of laws as they are experienced, interpreted by different actors. These could include governed populations, marginalized elite populations, and so on and so forth, as well as elite actors and formal legal actors like judges, politicians, and so on and so forth. And to answer your second question about why I thought this was a helpful approach to analyze this complex topic of rights in Southeast Asia. Well, first of all, as I mentioned, I am trained and I am a specialist on law and society. And to me, as I looked at the very plural region of Southeast Asia where I grew up, it occurred to me always, has always been to me that we have to understand how people experience rights or experience the law from the ground up. And these experiences and interpretations are probably going to differ from place to place, from social group to social group. And I thought this the socio-legal approach was naturally a good fit for understanding rights in Southeast Asia.
Experiencing the law from the ground up, that's quite powerful. And I'm actually quite intrigued by the case you made for an empirical informed nature of the politics of rights, as opposed to the liberal rights perspective and the critical rights perspective. How does your work on Southeast Asia speaks to these debates?
I see a socio-legal approach as a way to interrogate or verify claims from these different normative perspectives, whether it is a liberal rights perspective or a critical rights perspective. Again, to make it more succinct for my explanation, you know, a liberal rights perspective person might believe in the power of rights to protect and empower marginalized populations. A critical rights perspective scholar will have a more skeptical view, a very critical view perhaps of rights, doubting its ability to fulfill these liberal promises of rights. Now, these perspectives are what are normatively driven in the sense that the scholar takes the view prescribing or arguing that rights work or rights are great or rights don't work because they bring certain harms to certain populations. The socio-legal approach, they do not take these normative claims as a given or as a conclusion, but it sets out to find out whether these claims actually are realized or whether they actually materialize on the ground. And perhaps the conclusion through the analysis of the data that the researcher collects is a little bit more nuanced, but perhaps it might sometimes support the normative claims of the liberal rights perspective, or in some cases, it could lend support to the critical rights scholar's perspective.
So does that mean that the socio-legal approach is then normatively ambivalent, that on its own, it's not advancing a particular normative agenda compared to the liberal and critical rights perspective?
This is actually a very good question. And I think it's a question that all socio-legal scholars should constantly bear in mind as they go about with their empirical research. Now, at first glance, it would appear that it is normative ambivalent, perhaps because we take the view that rights or law are what the people on the ground or this social group that you're investigating experience or say what they mean. And now you would take it to its logical conclusion. You will say that, well, then does it mean that it is whatever these people mean, and therefore it's ambivalent. So I actually struggled with that, and I perhaps you saw that in as you read the politics of rights in Southeast Asia as well. But at the same time, I'm quite well aware of the socio-legal studies tradition. I'm actually trained in law and society in the US, and from that line of law and society tradition, a lot of that scholarship and the pioneers of that field were very much influenced by progressive politics. And they do set about trying to understand, or they did set about trying to understand the promise and also the limits of rights in improving the lives of the marginalized. So when I go back and think about this tradition and this deep commitment to the improvement of the lives of the marginalized and the concerns for them, it becomes really hard to say necessarily that sociolegal studies is normative ambivalent. And that's why in the volume, I talked about an emic and etic approach. And of course, some scholars may disagree with me working in the same field. I think that the way to sort of break out of this quandary is perhaps to go, when we are going about fieldwork, understanding the perspectives of different populations, we have to take an emic approach, which is understanding the insider's perspective, understanding what rights mean, how they're experienced on the ground. But as we are analyzing what this means for the future of rights, for the improvement of social equality or social divides, I think it's also important to toggle back and take an ethic perspective and think about what we have learned from these insiders, how that actually informs theories and the literature on law and society about the power of rights and the potential to improving or informing social inequalities.
I think the book's normative position really becomes highlighted towards the end. The book actually has a very powerful ending.
I think that what I meant in that sentence was to encourage more scholars to empirically investigate the meanings of rights and its impact on the ground on different social groups, especially the populations that have historically been marginalized in certain societies or in their societies, I should say, and see actually how rights can empower them or perhaps in some cases disempower them or not bring any improvement to their lives before we make a conclusion or draw a conclusion about whether rights are useful or not. And in that process, that's why I said we have to also embrace its incoherence in the sense that perhaps in different places, different social groups may carry out different tactics, different strategies to mobilize rights. Incoherence or diversities in the ways in which they reap the consequences of these mobilization of rights. And so we have to embrace and try to understand these different results and outcomes. And from there, form perhaps a more granular conclusion about the possibilities and the limitations of rights. And in that process, we are therefore giving rights a chance, but not drawing a conclusion, but letting rights have a chance of becoming different things and taking on different shapes and forms.
Yeah, I think from what I remember from the book, you actually mentioned that rights in Southeast Asia haven't managed to turn into a hegemonic structure, right? Like rights mobilization is just one of various practices that people turn to when they're faced with problems. They can turn to, of course, the law to sue somebody, but people can also turn to religion or village norms instead of using legal institutions. So it really has a diversity of the ways in which rights is experienced. Can you tell us more about this insight?
When I wrote that sentence about how rights is not yet a hegemonic structure in most Southeast Asian societies, I was perhaps in the back of my mind having a conversation with some scholars who in some cases perhaps sound a right warning bell that, yes, rights can do many things that are positive, but at the same time, Perhaps it can also become such an overwhelming structure that it occludes other ways of thinking of solutions. And so I was sort of, in the back of my mind, I was having a conversation with these scholars. And my response, if I were as situated in Southeast Asia, to say that, wait a minute, this is not the situation in which empirically many people can observe in Southeast Asian societies and among social groups. In some cases, right, maybe one set of discourse or resources that a group of people can resort to, but it's not necessarily the only one. As you mentioned, there's religion, village norms, and so on and so forth. And also, oftentimes, if you empirically investigate the use of rights, in this case, constitutional rights or human rights discourse, international human rights discourse in this part of the world, often there is a pushback or there are criticisms or there's retaliation from powerful parties like the state or other oppositional groups that might criticize the use of rights as being unsuited for that given culture or society. And these would suggest that rights is not so widely accepted, so not widely institutionalized, and therefore it's not really a hegemonic structure, but really at this stage in many of these societies, a set of resources that they can turn to. And perhaps over time, rights might become more institutionalized as a structure, and perhaps the concern that it is a hegemonic ideology might come to fruition. But at this point, empirically, perhaps we are not there yet.
Right, yes. That's a very helpful way of looking at it, actually. It's one thing that people can turn to, but not the only thing that they turn to, depending on their context. Your book is part of the Cambridge Element series in Politics and Society in Southeast Asia, edited by no other than Professors Ed Aspinall and Meredith Weiss, of course. And we've featured some of the Element series in the podcast as well. But for our listeners who are not familiar with the series, Elements basically invites authors to write a short book, I think not more than 30,000 words, if I'm not mistaken. And the challenge for the author is to write a comprehensive review of the debates in the field written in a clear and accessible manner. Professor Chua, that is quite a task. There is so much to say about the topic. And I think, my impression at least, is there is a tension between giving a coherent storyline, but also not essentializing the region. So what was your strategy in writing the book? What advice can you give to our listeners who are contemplating writing an overview of their field of expertise, but feel overwhelmed by it?
When the editors of the series first approached me, they pitched this element as being about human rights in Southeast Asia. And I had to pause for a while when I got the invitation and think, seriously, do I really want to write such a volume? Can I do it? Because we know the debates around human rights in the region, and there has also been quite a few volumes around this issue of human rights in Southeast Asia, some of them looking at particular countries within Southeast Asia, some are more ambitious, looking at the entire region. And I decided that that's not what I want to write, and also that's something, the pitfalls of writing such a volume, or the challenges, rather, for me, I feel were not something that I wanted to take on. Instead, I stood back and tried to think about why I was hesitant is precisely the starting point that I ended up with for the volume is that the region is so plural, plural cultures, plural normative orders, legal former legal systems, and so on and so forth, different genealogies of rights, and also different outcomes when people mobilize rights. And so I responded to the editors and suggested, can I do something that is more suited to my type of research, more of a law and society or sociolegal approach to the study of rights in the region. And we came to an understanding, which eventually became the volume that you read. So once I got that sorted out, the pathway was a little bit clearer. I was going to start with the three questions that I posed. How do you study rights in a region that's so plural in terms of cultures and normative systems, that is plural in terms of the different origins and genealogies and discourses of rights, and plural in terms of the different outcomes when you mobilize rights? And from there, I was able to introduce the study of politics of rights, study of rights mobilization in my field of law and society, and go from there.
Finally, Professor Chua, tell us what you're working on now and how we can stay updated with your work.
I'm currently working on two projects. One is looking at parental maintenance laws in several Asian countries. That is, state laws that require adult children under some circumstances to provide financial maintenance and in some cases emotional support to their aging parents. I'm interested in the conditions under which parents might choose to use this kind of law against their children. And I'm conducting this research at research sites that include Singapore, Vietnam, certain parts of China, and also Taiwan. The other project I'm working on is with an assistant professor at the New School for Social Research in New York, assistant professor Gary Lee, or Jack Jin Gary Lee. We call this project Governing Through Contagion. It was inspired by COVID and the pandemic, but it's not entirely about COVID-19. In fact, we are interested in the developments of government strategies of control against different contagious diseases, and how their public health governance strategies and legislation regulations have morphed and changed from colonial period to the contemporary period in response to the changes in medical technology and other kinds of technology, in response to the attributes and characteristics of different bacteria or viruses that are threatening the populations at that given time. So that's more of a historical ethnography project that we are working on at the moment.
Professor Lynette J. Chua is the author of Politics of Rights in Southeast Asia, published by Cambridge University Press. You've been listening to New Books in Southeast Asian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. This has been one of hundreds of conversations about other Southeast Asia-related books on the channel. You can download or stream these interviews free of charge from the New Books Network website or subscribe through your favorite podcast app.